It'd be good, since he kind of drafted me into this, to get a little work out of this guy, since he's a Luther historian and church historian. So what we're going to do today is, let me say, I'm Bishop in the La Crosse Area Synod. And when I started on this study, we had 17 members of this group. And we represented different elements of the church. I think probably I was there because I was a pastor of rural parish and a woman. And during the course of those 5 years, I became an assistant to the bishop and then very recently a bishop of the church. So my life changed the most dramatically of anybody's on the task force, but a number of people changed positions during those 5 years. What we're going to do today is I'm going to give you a little introduction to how this whole thing happened. And then Mark will give you some Lutheran background. As you can see, what I'm going to show you is that the tradition of the church and history was a very important part of the mandate. And Mark will not necessarily follow the book, but that's not important. He's going to give a good Lutheran historic background. And then we'll talk about some of the, not all of it. This is 5 years of volumes and professors and all kinds of people across the church that talk to us. But in a very few minutes, we'll just center in on a few of what I think are probably the touchier, sensitive issues of the proposal. So let me give you a little background first to start.
One thing I should say, that this is, we want to dedicate this session to Sven,
who is
voting on it at the churchwide assembly.
Mark and I don't agree on everything either, which I thought was an additional fun factor for this session. But some will argue about this, but basically the one issue that almost caused us to not have a merger, and some people would say, well, that's too bad, I wish we wouldn't have had a merger, but nevertheless, what almost caused us not to have a merger, and we just almost quit at that point, was an argument between the American Lutheran Church, Lutheran Church in America, and the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Church, which was an offshoot of the Missouri Synod, on how to order ministries. And at that time, probably the hottest issue was how to order lay ministries. And we all had vastly different ways of doing it, and it was an extremely hot subject. And then actually a couple folks from Iowa, Dave Brown and a few others, came up with an idea to have a six-year study at that time it was called, to form a commission to study this issue and come up with a proposal. One of the difficulties for Lutherans is that we've really never had any absolute prescribed laying out of ministry in any kind of formal book. So we've spent a lot of time arguing about it probably since the time of Luther, and we probably will continue to do that. So let me tell you what the mandate was, because I think that's always important. We were asked hundreds and thousands of things. Were we going to do this? Were we going to do that? And we basically tried to stick to our mandate. So I think it's important to share the mandate with you, and I've got it in kind of a short form here. We were asked by the continuing resolution that during the period of 88 to 94, and you can see the first thing we did was shorten it to 93. It's the first thing we did when we got together. Shall engage an intensive study of the nature of ministry leading to decisions regarding appropriate forms of ministry that will enable this church to fulfill its mission. So mission was really at the center of this mandate. During the course of this study, special attention shall be given to the tradition of Lutheran Church, which I asked Mark to do a piece on that today, the possibility of articulating a Lutheran understanding and adaptation of the threefold ministerial office of bishop, pastor, and deacon, and its ecumenical implication. Here, you can read my writing. And then the third thing, the appropriate forms of lay ministries to be officially recognized and certified by this church, including criteria for certification. In addition, the church council added specific consideration of the ministry of all the baptized people of God to the scope of the study, which I forgot to add here as I was writing. Now, we had a lot of discussion about what this meant, engage the church in study. A lot of us assumed engaging the church in study was to engage the whole church in study. There are a number of people on the task force that thought that meant we were supposed to study it on behalf of the church. And it's interesting how you think some words are so clear and it, everybody's disagreeing. So that's how we started. But we did spend a lot of time working with the whole church on this. We had hearings all over the country after about a year. We had forums all over the whole country. The original document, which was sent out in 1991, which was kind of our first document on the study, was sent out to 30,000 people in church. Anybody who signed up anywhere and had some interest on receiving our kind of quarterly reports on this received them. There are many, many, like I said, 30,000 plus people on that list who have been receiving for 5 years the documents. I also want to say, because Gracia Grindel who was one of the task force members, made a comment on the cost of this study. The cost of this study came out of funds that were set aside by these predecessor bodies for this study. I think almost $3 million was set aside for this study, and we used about a third of that. So even though it sounds like an incredible amount of money, this is a huge church, and this task force was extremely frugal, and I think anybody would be more than happy to have people look at our books, and we were very, very careful and considered cost all the way through it, even though that money had been put in a special fund and set aside. It did not come out of this new church's benevolent dollars. So I want to share that with you. Now, I think, Mark, why don't you take
on? What I want to do is, in about 10 minutes, set the context in which this study operated. And I should, I think, at the outset lay out my own cards. I support most of the recommendations, although not the rationale behind the recommendations in this report, with one exception, and that's on the ordination of deacons. So I want you to realize I'm coming at it with a slightly different point of view. In determining something like the proper understanding of ministry within the church, there are various sources that the commission and we Lutherans can turn to. There is Scripture. Unfortunately, Scripture is quite ambiguous. It describes different forms of ministry, and so you can't really draw hard and fast conclusions from it, although there are various bodies who think they can. And, of course, it's what they're doing is they're projecting into that what they want to find, and then, of course, finding it. The other possibility is tradition, which is somewhat of an ambiguous authority within our tradition. Our tradition is to be suspect of tradition. And beyond that, even tradition is ambiguous, since forms of ministry have changed quite noticeably over time. The third area, and this is one that's actually drawn on heavily by individuals involved in this debate, and it is a debate, is the Lutheran confessions. The Lutheran confessions in the 16th century, the primary one is the Augsburg Confession. They even argue about the unaltered Augsburg versus the altered Augsburg. And then there's the Book of Concord, which is Augsburg Confession plus various other documents that were gathered together by Lutherans, among which are the Schmalkald articles that I'll have occasion to refer to later. And behind all of these confessions are the works of Luther. And in fact, several of Luther's own works are part of the Book of Concord, and his thinking plays an important role. Now, the ideologically speaking, that is, the claim is made that the confessions are simply a restatement of scriptural truth. Whatever one can say about that as a faith position, historically it's a difficult one to defend, just because there has been an evolution over time. And if we believe in the Holy Spirit, we believe the Holy Spirit has to be operating in this evolution. So it's a complicated mix. What I want to do is set the confessions, because they play an important role in the debate, into this context. First, you need a little background, because Luther and the other, the princes, for example, who subscribed to the Augsburg Confession, were not operating in a vacuum. When they talked about bishops or deacons or priests or the two estates or what have you, they were operating out of a particular situation which is drastically different in noticeable ways from the situation we're dealing with now. One of the concerns that I have as a historian, and it's not just a professional concern, but is that some of the people involved in this debate go back to the confessions with a lack of sophistication and a lack of historic awareness that they would not tolerate
if it was being done to the scriptures. I mean, in scriptures, you ask for what is the context, you ask for differences, you try to get behind what's being said. There's some people who will go to the book, to the confessions, as if they were holy writ, and simply cite out without asking what they really mean. Let me give you some of the context. First, Luther himself, when Luther began his teaching at Wittenberg and when the Reformation began, society was literally divided into two parts. They were called the two estates. There was the lay estate, which was the great majority of people, and there was the clerical estate, maybe 10% of the population. The clerical estate had its own distinct clothing, its own distinct laws, its own distinct system of taxation. It would be a little like saying that the clergy here would not have to pay Washington State income tax or any other taxes. They would not have to obey Washington State laws, and they would dress distinctly to show that they were different. And the general feeling was the clerical estate was superior to the lay estate. So this is a context which we just don't see today, even within Catholicism. With Roman Catholicism, the distinction is no longer operating. So that's important to realize. The second thing is that one entered into the clerical state various ways, but for the purposes of this discussion, the main one was through ordination, where you were ordained into the clergy. Ordination was thought of as a sacrament, like baptism or the Eucharist. And like baptism, it could only be done once. And the belief was it left an indelible mark on the soul. So once you were baptized, once you were ordained, you're ordained. You can't undo it. You can't leave the order. So once you are ordained, that's forever. This is also important because the Lutheran understanding of ordination, on this point, there's been disagreement in the tradition. There are some that want to say it's time-bound. Others say that once you're ordained forever. In the two estates, there were a threefold ministry. There were the deacons, which were very weak at this point. They were really just a way station on the way to being a priest. They had had much larger functions earlier on, but that had essentially disappeared in the preceding 1,000 years. There were priests who were ordained, and then there were bishops. This is a threefold ministry that's traditional within Catholicism and something like Anglicanism or the Episcopalian tradition. Luther, looking at this, on the basis of his understanding of justification by faith alone and his reading of the scriptures, actually redefined it in a radical way. He threw out the whole notion of the two estates and said that every Christian, by virtue of his or her baptism, belonged both within the church and within the world. So he kept the division, but he said everyone who was a Christian was in both. And drawing on Paul and on Hebrews, he said that all Christians, by virtue of their baptism, were priests. They belonged to the royal priesthood. So that by virtue of your baptism, every one of you are priests. Of course, the Catholics got very upset with this notion because they were still working with the notion of two estates. But baptism for Luther brought you into the royal priesthood. Now, Luther himself was an ordained priest as well as a monk. And he had been ordained by a bishop, as was appropriate. That is, within the threefold ministry, the bishops did the ordaining. But he looked around and the church wouldn't reform according to his understanding of things and his reading of the scripture. And so he had to face the problem, if the bishops are not going to ordain any people who believe the way we do, if they're not going to be reformed, how do we get ministers? How do we get pastors in our community? And in the emergency situation, in the early years of what's called the Reformation, Luther insisted that the authority that a priest exercises, or a pastor exercises, is no different than the authority that anyone who is baptized has. The only difference is that you're taken from your private position as a baptized Christian and put in the public ministry. So it's by virtue of your baptism that you can act as an ordained priest or pastor. He didn't like the word priest because it had notions of sacrifice. During the emergency, in the early period, before he could get bishops to cooperate with him or governments to cooperate with him, he said that in the emergency situation, if a bishop won't act, if the prince won't act, the congregation itself of baptized Christians has the right to choose one of their numbers, and single that person out. It would have been a male in Luther's time. Single that person out for ministry, the public exercise of ministry, and the congregation could lay on hands. This is an emergency situation, because as soon as things are working properly, according to Luther's understanding, then people should be singled out through proper channels, which in many cases involved the prince in his day, or the replacements, the sort of Protestant bishops that developed. In his understanding of ministry, he also attacked the traditional threefold ministry, that is, bishop, priest or presbyter, and deacon. Remember, Luther believed that the most important thing was the word of promise, that Christ has died for you and for your sins, and if you believe that he has done this for you, if you believe God's promise that Christ has done this for you, then you are saved by virtue of that belief, without works. And so for him, that one ministry that was involved, the one public ministry, but also the ministry that all priesthood of all believers individually would exercise, was the ministry of preaching the word of promise, or exercising the word of promise in its visible form, the sacraments. You might wonder why we Lutherans make such a big thing about whenever we take communion, the person says, this is Christ's body given for you, or Christ's blood shed for you. You know, you hear those words when you get the bread and the wine. That's the promise, which is crucial. That's center. And the visible sign of that are the bread and the wine. And so the ministry of word and sacrament could be seen as just the ministry of the word in two different forms. The word is the preached word, and the word is the visible form of the sacrament. So it's one ministry. Now, when you go beyond Luther and you look at Lutherans, and the Augsburg Confession, they picked up these concerns about the priesthood of all believers, about baptism as being the one way in which one enters into the priesthood of all believers, and the one ministry of word and sacrament, by arguing that a minister is someone who is rightly or properly called, and that there's no distinction between a bishop and a priest, or a presbyter. So in Lutheranism, their Lutheran understanding of the one ministry, pastors can ordain another pastor. It does not require a bishop. They explicitly state the only difference between a bishop and a pastor is a human distinction for good order. That is, it's not something that God has made, but it's something that human beings have made in order to order the church. In the Augsburg Confession, which is our central confessional document, there's no mention of deacons in any way that helps with the issues of whether deacons should be ordained. In the Schmalkald articles, however, which are in the Book of Concord and which are an elaboration on the Augsburg Confession, I should explain. The Augsburg Confession attempted to get as close to the Catholic position as possible. It is an ecumenical document before ecumenism. So they didn't raise a lot of issues that were divisive, that they thought were not of crucial importance. They raised only those things that they thought that the word stands, you know, the church stands or falls on these particular issues. Later, when it became clear that reconciliation was unlikely, they added the Schmalkald articles, which dealt with some issues that they had avoided earlier on. For example, the papacy finally comes in for critical comment here. In the Schmalkald articles, there's a distinction made between bishops and presbyters and deacons. And bishops and presbyters are ordained, singled out and ordained. And deacons, the distinction is deacons are not ordained, although they still are ministers in a certain sense, beyond the normal priesthood of all believers. And I think that's one of the issues where it's most disputed. Is this distinction here. And that's basically the background.
I'm going to rush here because I want you to be able to chew here. Let me see a few things about, there's 50-some proposals from the Task Force and Study Ministry coming to the Assembly, most of which I think will be passed, but let me try to give you some of the rub areas. One of the areas that we discussed at length was the word call. It was very offensive to many of the lay people on our task force that call was basically used for ordained, and they made a convincing argument. And so call is really now, will now, if it's passed, and I'm assuming that, or hoping that it'll be passed, the word call will be used for all ministries of the church in which we basically somebody is rostered, and even a congregation can call somebody to a position, so you don't even necessarily need to be an associate ministry or a deacon, diaconal minister, or a pastor. So that word became much wider for the church, and I think very significantly so.
I've been here a little late. Did you define rostered already?
I don't think we actually define that in this document, but basically roster is what the ELCA keeps track of, those ministries in the church. And if you are, that would differentiate from a congregation necessarily having somebody and giving them a title, the congregation. They could give them a title of deacon, the church, and that would not make you a deacon of the ELCA. We have a number of deacons, small groups of deacons throughout this church. Doesn't make you a deacon of the ELCA. A rostered person right now has to be a pastor or a certified associate ministry. And those are the only people other than one small group of deaconesses which are actually called ELCA deaconess group, and they are the only people that we actually keep lists of in the church. And associates in ministry and pastors are accountable to the discipline of the church. Good question. Just to remind you, ministry equals service, and even though this whole discussion is how do we divide up power and authority in the church is part of what we're talking about here, even so, the word ministry itself basically means service.
If I might chime in, the current way of talking about the priesthood of all believers is the ministry of all the baptized. That's the contemporary phrase for that.
And if you get a chance to... you'll be receiving this in the mail if you haven't received it yet. Sven, you have one? Good. And anybody who wants one can get one. You just contact the Division of Ministry and they will make sure you have one, because we are committed to getting this out to people who want to read it. But I want to say in this piece that this is the best statement on the ministry of the baptized I've seen anywhere. And we can complain all over the place about how poorly that is defined in the church. And we brought in all kinds of scholars and theologians. Nobody has a PhD in the ministry of the baptized. It's very, very hard and almost impossible to find a scholar and a theologian in the church that can speak at length about the ministry of the baptized. It's sort of a little bit about the ministry of the baptized, and then I talk about the ordained, and they can talk to you for hours. And we basically have not treasured this. This is probably one of our biggest gifts of the Reformation, is the priesthood of all believers, which of course includes clergy, and ministry of baptized, of course, includes clergy. And yet we really haven't taken that gift further and actually had some people who have specialized in the theology of this. Then some of the touchy spots, if you can remember here, we were supposed to discuss this threefold. Most of the Lutherans in the world do have a threefold ministry: bishop, pastor, deacon. And that's hard for me to remember, because I sometimes feel like I am the world in the United States, but it's not true. The majority of Lutherans do have threefold. And that is something that just absolutely grates against American Lutherans, and I think that includes Missouri Synod or Wisconsin Synod, whatever. It's not part of our, really in many ways, democratic ideals, and I support that in a personal way. I'm not a threefold person. And I was very, very happy. I was actually in the subcommittee. We broke into subcommittees on bishops prior, quite a bit before my election. It continued after my election. I got off at that point, but I thought it was a very good idea to have six-year terms. It came originally out of some of our synods that have been most uptight about the power of bishops, but basically I think bishops spend too much time involved in politics. I also personally support terms for bishops as far as limited terms, but not all of our synods have that. I feel that even more strongly now that I've been a bishop. I think that we do have not very much authority in the Lutheran Church, but we've got maybe too much anyway. And so I think to keep a little control, that would be is a good idea. So I support that.
May I chime in at one
yes,
thing at this point?
Ahead.
One of the issues of the threefold ministry that was not addressed in this document directly, but was almost sort of an end run, that's my view of it, with the proposed full communion between the Episcopalians and the Lutherans, was the historic episcopate. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Lutherans rejected was the notion that the apostolic doctrine and the validity of the apostolic doctrine depended on a succession of bishops passing it on. And the objection was
zapping each other,
the guaranteeing the truth by this succession. Their objections were twofold, and I would think they're valid today. One, there isn't a historic succession of bishops. There are big gaps. And two, it theologically doesn't make a whole lot of sense. They did believe in an apostolic succession of doctrine, of right belief. This, the church did not, in this document, is not taking the position of adopting the threefold, which the Episcopalian...
And this, you know, this just is so foreign to a Lutheran background. I mean, it just is beyond our understanding that we would think that the gospel would be ensured by bishops. I mean, but that's really core for Episcopalians.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just absolutely core. And I think it helped me to talk to just a lay Episcopal person recently who said, you know, the bishop comes and confirms us, and we just feel like we're a member of the whole church. We don't think of ourselves as being a member of a congregation like you Lutherans do. We think of ourselves as being a member of the whole church, and that comes to us by bishops. And I don't think confirmation has anything to do with the apostolic succession or historic episcopate, either one or episcopate. But okay, then the touchy one, diaconal ministers, and I think maybe the best thing is to just read a little bit of this section.
This is the one where I disagree.
We voted three separate times on this issue of ordaining diaconal ministers. And this was 5 years of studying and struggling with this issue. And we voted over a 9-month period. And the very first time we voted, I voted against it. I was one of the four people that voted against ordaining diaconal ministers. And then I went back and talked to a couple. I was actually feeling physically ill after our task force had decided to ordain or propose ordaining diaconal ministers. And I went back and feeling totally sick and depressed, and I talked to a couple of really strong advocates for lay people in the church who have been doing this for about 20 years, just powerful, outspoken, sharp theological minds. Both lay people, and they were quite excited about it. And that completely shocked me. Then we came back to our next meeting, and we went around for the first time and talked about individually why we had voted the last time, and nobody knew how everybody voted. And then what we were going to do this time. And I changed my vote. And I voted for ordained diaconal ministers, and I'll tell you why. It's not terribly theological. I listened to the people of God as they went around the room, and the people who, now Gracia Grindel, who is a friend of mine, who voted against this proposal on the task force, felt that the four people who voted against it the first time were lay people. And that's incorrect. And I thought that time that I knew I was one of them that had voted against it, but I didn't think it was the lay people who voted against it. In fact, the second time when we went through and talked about it, there was only one lay person that had voted against ordaining diaconal ministers, and that was Gracia. And people voted on the basis of completely, totally different reasons. I heard 17 different reasons of how people got where they wanted. and the people who voted for ordaining diaconal ministry. And yet, and I have to say too, in our arguing against it, that I still see, and I'm waiting, I don't have any strong feelings about this ordination either way at the diaconal office, but I would like to see people who, lay people who have been strong advocates of lay people in the church and who are good theologians, be the leaders of the people who are trying to turn around this ordination of diaconal ministers. Now the task force ministry, because this is the way it was designed from the beginning, we didn't design it, this is the way it was designed, will go in as it is. This report goes in as it is. As you probably, many of you probably know, the Board of Ministry receiving the most letters they ever have in 5 years on any subject, and they received a lot of letters really upset about this ordination of the diaconal ministers. And by the way, the report was not out yet. And it was also clear that to the 5 task force members who came to that meeting, and probably all of us would have been there, but we knew that it would be passed, we weren't there, that a number of people who were really upset about it, you could tell from what they were saying, had not read the report either. And so I guess what I'm waiting for is for people to read it. And if the lay people of this church read this report and do not want to ordain diaconal ministers, and I say, let's not ordain them. But I think if the lay people of this church would like to ordain diaconal ministers, we ought to pay attention to it and give it a crack.
I just want to know if some of this strong reaction was from the deaconesses themselves.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Because we spent a week in the deaconess community as minister in residence.
Which one?
Up at the Gladwin.
Okay.
Just outside.
Well,
they're
just general. They would be generally upset with the church, I think, Pennsylvania.
Well.
But actually, their person from that community voted for it. Okay. They're fortunate because they're the only deaconess community that actually had somebody from the community on the task force, and their person did actually vote for ordaining diaconal ministers.
I'm curious to find out if most of the reasons for voting for diaconal ordination had to do with economics, the pension plan, and say general prestige in the church. I mean, was that most of it?
Oh, I don't think so at all.
That's interesting.
I don't think so at all. I can't say what other people are feeling out there, but in the task force, I think it was the mission of the church, flexibility of office. Now, I read in the forum, that was before the report came out, the argument that, you know, what we're going to do is ordain preschool people, which I thought was really sad that would be lifted up as something negative, first of all. It was never discussed in the task force. Nobody ever talked about preschool teachers. Nobody even thought about preschool teachers. But it's interesting to me that was lifted up in the first sentence as a negative of why you shouldn't ordain diaconal ministers. It says something about
how we value teachers.
That's right, and preschool people. And secondly, they said these people are going to preach. There's never been one person on the task force of study ministry that understood in any shape or form that these people would be preaching. And even when Mark is talking about one office of ministry over here, Article 5, which talks about the ministry of word and sacrament, is interpreted by many scholars, including the task force, and we were in agreement on that was a ministry that did not belong to the presbyter, to pastors, but to the church, which I think you've been saying too, Mark, but maybe not. But Article 5 would be belonging, and I want to say too that we went with the Augsburg Confession, and that has been our ecumenical document that we have done all of our dialogues with, which is accepted by all Lutherans.
Article 5 doesn't help very much.
No, but it's a form of big discussion.
Yeah, Article 5 is the whole church, there's no doubt. That we may obtain this faith, the ministry of teaching the gospel and administering the sacraments was instituted. For through the word and sacraments, as through instruments, the Holy Ghost is given, who works faith, where and when it pleases God, in them that hear the gospel, to wit, that God, not for our own merit, but for Christ's sake, justifies those who believe that they are received into the grace for Christ's sake. and goes on to condemn Anabaptists and others who think that the Holy Ghost comes to men without the external word through their own preparations and works. It belongs to the whole church. It doesn't belong to the ordained.
That's right.
But the question of who exercises it, and that's answered in Article 14. Of ecclesiastical order, they teach that no one should publicly teach in the church or administer the sacraments unless he be regularly called. Mm-hmm. Regularly is the recte in Latin, which means rightly or properly called.
And I guess, you know, really how it came down, and I think basically felt very much that Lutherans are free to order ministry however they feel mission can be served. And that was the primary mandate of this whole thing, was the mission of the church. I think the other argument that I saw on the forum, which I think is really, really weak, and that is that it would muddle up the church. What we have going on right now is we have a minimum of 20% of our pastors serving in what many people would say is not word and sacrament, are not doing the Eucharist, are not baptizing, are maybe hardly ever preaching, if ever. And yet we continue to call them pastors.
Why?
They would much more likely fit as the ethical ministers. Well, because the church seems to have a need to ordain these people and to make them sort of official ministries of the church, representing the church. And we value that as being something that needs to be ordained, and they're clearly doing what would fall in this document as diaconal ministry.
If I could give you a slightly different spin on that. The notion of whether ordination is for life or whether ordination is functional is operating here. That is ordination, is the public ministry a functional understanding? As long as you're exercising the ministry of word and sacrament, you are ordained, and when you cease, and you could argue about how long you have to cease it before it happens, when you cease it, do you then step back into the general ministry of all the baptized? And that's something that Lutherans have been arguing about for a long time, what you might call low, high and
Lutherans
low.
Do not reordain.
No, they do not
reordain. And we show our hand at that point.
Right.
We are not functionalists, and I think that, you know, there are many people at task force that when fits of anger would accuse Gracia of being a functionalist, and she would get extremely angry because Lutherans are not functionalists, and so we don't just do it for the sake of good order. We're closer into the heritage of the church than that.
Yep.
And we have a divine, we see it as a divine office.
Yeah, divine call, not simply a mediated call.
That's right. And we see pastors, and I think there's an argument for that as diaconal minister. If you're talking about a diaconal minister of the church, ordained, that means you come under accountability of the whole church. And what do we do as Lutherans? Now, I realize that for a while, in an emergency situation, we were calling people right out of the congregation. But right now, one of the major factors for ordination is that you come from the outside, and you come as a bearer of the preached word and the sacraments on behalf of the whole church into that community. It's very significant that you come from the outside as a sign and symbol of the whole church to that community of the church. And that makes that diaconal minister also accountable to the whole church. And I don't think, you know, as I was looking at this again, of course, Mark and I have been having a lot of fun. We have been.
I got a reply here.
You got a reply. You got a chance. One more second. But I think when I looked at this, I thought, again, today, I thought, this is really, we people who have some real concerns about justice in the church shouldn't so quickly lay aside the ordained diaconal ministers as something that we don't want. Because we haven't done so well with the justice and the service end. And if you look at this report, the diaconal ministers are absolutely compelled to this, the needs of the poor, the laity, the ministry of the laity in the church. That's one of the charges of this report. So just before you sink it, on the basis of what you've read in forum and some of these other things, don't look at these hard and say, do we want to say? We have a chance for maybe the first time in the church to argue that this service dimension is as significant. Word and the ministry to the poor and to the suffering is just as significant as the sacramental ministry of the church. And if we have any belief in that, this may be a chance to say that to the church. That's my latest new argument.
Let me briefly reply on that. We should really get everyone involved. I'm a strong supporter of diaconal ministry, and I think they should be commissioned and be rostered as commissioned diaconal. What I have problems with is the confusion of the notion of ordination and ordination within these two offices, because the ordination is, as I understand it, and an ordination historically and traditionally within the whole church has been ordination to word and sacrament. And that there are provision discussions in there, and I think very incomplete and unconvincing, about how you could move back and forth between a presbyter and deacon. And what happens if someone is ordained as a deacon and later decides that she wants to exercise the ministry of word and sacrament? We don't reordain. So there has to, but there is proposal of different rights. But it raises a lot of problems, both administratively and I think theologically. It strikes me it should be possible to recognize the importance of diaconal service and make it a public ministry accountable to the whole church without confusing the understanding of ordination. I would, as part of that, although politically it's probably impossible, I would make some changes about those people on the clergy roster who are not involved in sacraments in ministry of word and sacrament. I would in some way retire them from it. But that's my...
You, of course, would be shot.
I know. I mean, politically. And
your
so there
life
are,
would be in danger.
And there is a
I see a hand over here.
You see, there's a grandfather clause in here which would, from this point forward, it passed. People who were not in the ministry of word and sacrament, or say in counseling roles and like, would be in diaconal ministry. But those who right now are on the clergy roster but are in things like counseling would be grandfathered in. Well, that indicates this is the politics of the problem, which is considerable. And I would just like, to the extent I can, to try to keep our theology and understanding what's going on as close to the historical tradition as we can, as consistent with our understanding of ministry, while at the same time emphasizing diaconal ministry. And that, now it's your turn for...
Go ahead.
I've got a question about the diaconal piece. And everyone, you mentioned the fact that 20% of our clergy roster are non-word sacrament ministry. That's part of the concern. It's that by a vote at our National Assembly, it's not going to change the attitude in congregation about ordination. And that ordination is somehow a quote higher calling, ordination wouldn't sacrament, the current way it is and that kind of thing. And in the Lutheran Church we have a unique, especially around women, that we have been fortunate that the vast majority of our women are parish pastors.
Yes.
In other Protestant denominations, the vast majority of women are not parish pastors. It's exactly like the numbers. Like I think the Presbyterian Church USA, 20% of their women clergy are parish pastors. 80% are in those other ministries. And there's just some similar work in terms of congregational authority and autonomy around the calling of pastors for word and sacrament ministry. So my struggle with this is, will we erode the ability of all God's people to have access to being ordained to word and sacrament in the midst of the community? And are we at a point in our own history, might we have to wait to ordain deacons for another generation or two, so that we're real clear about the ministry of the baptized and everybody's access to that in terms of attitude and emotion?
That's a new point that I haven't heard. I'm very interested in that. Personally, of course, I'm always concerned about what happens to, and I haven't really thought of it quite like you're thinking of it, but I've always been concerned about what anything we do in the task force that might change it for women pastors.
Or people of color,
absolutely. Well, certainly, all the dimensions. Absolutely, it was on my mind all the time, and I haven't really thought about it quite like that, Carol.
Yeah. In the argument for women's ordination, there were about four areas, and the stopping place was always ecumenical implications. And it seems to me that we've got the same thing here, that I served at least part of the time at the local level on a Lutheran Episcopal dialogue, and always it's that, well, we can't talk to you if we don't have this together. It seems to me we can build an umbrella big enough to house our differences instead of having to always be alike. But it seems to me that that really is a very strong thing, that you get people such as the Writers of Forum or other such conservative papers that are looking for a way of kind of killing, if you will, on the basis of what this will do to the network of ecumenical talks. And I just don't think that's worth the cost.
Yeah. That's good. Thank you, Carol. Maybe you want to share your name with this group, yeah, too. Here.
Pardon?
Do you want to share your name?
Oh, Ralph Lustico.
Okay, Ralph.
Apparently, the definition of deacon is key to your task force thinking that didn't get across to all the letter writers. Do you have time to define it?
Well, let me see. We said diaconal minister, and that was because the historical viewpoint of deacon, which is buried a lot, and Mark could say more about that than I can, historically, we wanted this to be broader and more flexible. And I realize that that person might end up being called a deacon, but when we used diaconal minister, we wanted to keep it very broad and, in a sense, something new, because this church is constantly changing. So, diaconal minister, boy, that's a tough one. We kind of gave examples, and I think Mark is right. I don't think the argument was super strongly made, and I think part of it is because it is new, and when you're butting up against hundreds of years of history.
Well, how can you come down on a letter writer that questioned the ordination of a preschool person if it's not defined?
Oh, I can give you some.
I just heard you make the statement, yeah,
I'm talking about the way it was phrased. Yeah. It was phrased that this is what this was about. I can read it to you. It was never ever discussed, nor was it the intention of the diaconal ministers to be. I'm not saying that's bad. I don't think that's bad. I think it's sad it says something about the writer that they thought.
That's all it was.
Primarily women is
what all it was. In fact, I've got it with me so I can read.
While you're looking for that, the word for deacon means service, so there's a certain redundancy in saying diaconal ministry, your ministry is what you're talking about. What it is it's a called public ministry, not of word and sacrament, but a called and public ministry of the church, which is recognized and regulated by the church. That's one of the most important things, is the church, there's an element of responsibility involved, that all of us as baptized have a charge to minister, but we don't have to answer to the church as a whole in quite the same way as a diaconal minister would. So I think that's one of the big issues here. But I think you can do that without ordaining them.
Of course, in a flurry of panic, I cannot find the statement about the preaching, but the first sentence includes these words. This is the first sentence. Do all the members of your congregation know that within 6 months, the ELCA plans to add to its ordained clergy persons such as congregational educational leaders, operators of child and daycare centers, parish nurses, directors of church music programs, and many others like them. First of all, that is not part of the proposal. There was an appendix section that listed ideas, but was not part of the proposal. And secondly, I think that it says, it's a scare tactic here, and I thought it was unfortunate that it put operators of child and daycare centers as, I thought it said something about what they think of children, frankly.
No, I don't think
that's
so.
That's how I interpreted that.
I think it would be coming from the fact that you are not defining who you're going to ordain. Isn't that true? And so we're putting forward a list of potential people.
No, these were taken. Yeah. These were taken out of the appendix here. They have it in quotes. But I'm not saying it was deep. It wasn't. It's finally would go down to the division of ministry and the church council to get very, very specific. But basically, those are some of the ideas. That's not what I'm arguing about. It says later on in this piece, which I of course can't see now that I'm talking about it, but it talks about these people will preach.
Yeah, one of the things,
and they will not, and that has never ever been part of the proposal. These people will not be preachers.
Preachers in the sense of the pulpit, but they will be sharing the word, which they should be doing. I mean, we all should
be
doing
that. We all
should
be doing that.
But they will have, in their function, we'll have a special call to be sharing the word. I have not read as many as April, because I'm not on the, you know, she gets them probably sent to her. But they really are the opponents of this, of picking out things and exaggerating them and using arguments which might be fine in a political campaign but are a little unfortunate, you know, within the church. I still think there are real issues involved, but I would...
Well, what response should the people of the church take if they are against an issue like this? I think campaign is supposed to be one way of doing it.
I think it's excellent. I think it's wonderful that the people, I would be sick if the people cannot turn on the church. What I'm sad about is they didn't read the document. It wasn't out yet. That's what I'm distressed about. What people who read this and responded with letters and read, I got the material. I mean, people sent it to me. People who read that material that came out, I don't think I have all the letters that the material that was sent out, but people who read that material and did not read the study, most of them had not read the study yet, including some of the people of the board ministry. It was clear from what they said that they hadn't read the study.
The question, the broader question of what any of us should do is, I'd urge a couple things. One, there's not a lot of time left, but to the extent that your local church can discuss these issues, that's very good. The second thing is that you have delegates that will go to the General Assembly, and you should instruct them how you would like them to vote. And I would say one thing, and this is not April's fault at all, but one thing that's too bad about this, given its importance, is that the report was published so late, with relatively little time in which it would have been much better if we'd had a full year in which the community could have discussed and reacted about this. Because this is a big, potentially big change, both with positive and negative possibilities.
I do want to say, though, that and I spent a lot of time talking to people and asking about people, because I personally was so distressed with that first vote. I was very clear about that. I mean, it was physically... But I checked with people, and I wasn't hearing any response. I mean, I stood in front of the whole task force and said, we cannot ordain diaconals. This will never, ever fly in this church. And that was what I said the very first time we voted on it. But we came out with a report to over 30,000 people after each 3 months, and we voted on it 3 times, and we meet quarterly. We meet every 3 months. So I want to say that even though the report itself wasn't out, which I strongly regret, a number of us tried to get that out much earlier and just could not get the group to move on it, that the proposals themselves, almost every single one of these proposals, were out in report form 6 to 9 months before this document actually came out.
But the problem with that is that, especially...
It never feels final until you
right.
see it in a
we,
form.
And we are not normally willing to follow all the stages of it along, and our pastors often don't share the material with us. I mean, even though I teach at a divinity school, I don't get most of this stuff because I'm not ordained. That is a problem, even. And you don't know which of the possibilities, because as you said, you try to use your vote, you don't know which of these reports are ultimately going to end up in the final document.
Will it be voted on as a whole, is there a possibility that we
deliberately decided to go with each piece because we didn't want the whole thing to be defeated. I think we knew very much this diaconal ministry thing was controversial. And one of the neat things is this opening up of Ministry of the Baptized. No, that's not what I'm talking about. That is one of the neat things. But licensed ministry, and also people who are not getting compensated for the first time could stay on the roster if they're preaching. In other words, if you're taking time out to have children for 10 years and you would like to be preaching on Sundays, you will not be removed from the roster. If you want to preach or if you want to teach confirmation in the congregation as part of the pastoral staff, you want to donate your time to the church, we've got a lot of pastors sitting out there that are fully willing. They're not selling Lutheran Brotherhood or insurance or something else. They're just planning taking time out for a lot of its childcare is one of the issues.
Well, students also. I mean, I have
that's right.
College
and they're fully willing to serve, but all of a sudden we're putting the squeeze on them and saying, no, you're 3 years, you're off the roster.
If you don't do more than 20 hours of paid,
right.
You have to do more than half.
Yeah, that's a big change because it used to be that the pension fund majority
change.
Did it tied
in. And actually far more important than this ordination of diaconal ministers. Even though I try to give it as compelling as I can as a member of the task force, it is not really important to me. What's important to me is that lay people read it, and if the lay people of this church feel really strongly that they do not want these people to be ordained, I am absolutely 100% behind them. But I don't want, as a clergy person, to speak on behalf of the lay people. And right now, almost everything I've read has been clergy people saying the lay people hate this. Well, I want the lay people to read it, think about it, and if they hate it, great, let's dump it. I think absolutely, let's dump it if the lay people don't want it. I back that 100%, but I just hope they read it and make a decision as delegates to the assembly.
Sven, may I ask what your own thinking is about it at this point?
Came fast.
I read this Lutheran commentary. That's the first time I ever saw it. And that made me very interested. I couldn't see what all the fuss was about. I haven't read this, and I'm not that good at reading documents like that and understanding it the first time. So I appreciate this discussion.
And there'll be several more times at the assembly to sort of hear the church discuss it before we actually vote, which I think will be helpful.
This is the sort of thing that in any case should be a prayerful deliberate decision.
I feel opposite of what you feel about pastors being taken off the roster after 3 years. I saw a quote from Lowell Armin that after 3 years, it's a lot easier if it's automatic than if you have to make a judgment on it. That's what I thought he said.
Oh, I know. Listen, I did a lot of finagling to make sure we still have the retain the sort of the way of I'd have to show it to you, but there's some ways that we retain some things because I said bishops can't remove pastors no matter how incompetent they are. We can, but we don't.
So they have to have some.
We don't have enough courage to do that. And so we've just sort of slid people off with this three-year rule. On the other hand, we've had a number of other people, and that still has been, I think that was corrected. We spent, that was sort of a 10th hour correction, and I think we fixed that. And that was passed by the task force and supported by the church council. So I think that's okay. Well, we could look at that together if you'd like to. I support Lowell.
I'll share from a person doing interim work that I'm beginning to worry about that 3 year. I'm doing the exact same thing as the other pastors are. That 3 years I'll lose my roster.
But you won't if this is passed in August.
Right.
And
so
I think
I've been
it will
speaking
be.
The concern for that.
When you are doing word and sacrament ministry for the church.
Yeah. And I'm doing it full time, but I can be dropped.
And we can multiply the examples of that. It's a perverse system that's tied more to pension than to what you're actually doing.
The largest percentage of that are women.
Yeah, they are women, that's right. There are lots of good things in this report that I hope pass.
Actually, I'm kind of, in some ways, in a six or, and I is it real?
Yes.
I want to support your, the exciting thing to me, and really the most exciting thing to me, was that letter writing, the people of God could write letters and change. It was distressing to me that the report wasn't out yet. But I am absolutely excited that we still have a church as big as it is, that if enough people write letters, something can happen. That's the positive thing about that. That's very positive.
I believe people were responding to reports in the Lutheran